Welcome back to Day the Watara Party Line Talk Show. I'm your host, Lance Stacy, and today we're talking about addictions and recovery, and we're very fortunate to have two community members who are here to share their story with us. But alongside me here is my partner in crime, who's almost my second in command here, Jessica, who's like almost part of this thing. I don't know what else to say. It used to be Kattery, now it's Jessica. I think I'll start a little trouble between the sisters, you know.
We're not competing. But if we had to keep score, I'd be winning.
Here we go. The daggers are thrown. So I guess prior to going to break, we were talking with Dan, and he was sharing his story. And we're going to get back to him because I have a few more questions, but I felt we should introduce our second guest.
Right. So we've been doing two guests at a time on the show. And part of the reason is, you know, like I said earlier, there's a lot of different stories about sobriety. There's a lot of different journeys to sobriety. People have their different reasons. And also, you know, we really want to show people, you know, sort of like the experience of, you know, going through addiction or substance use for men, and even how it's different for women, because it's looked at differently. It feels different. So I want to introduce our next guest. We have Leora Charles with us.
Welcome, Leora.
Hi.
You want to share a little bit about just your journey?
Sure. So it started with drinking at a young age, 14 years old, and I just fell in love with the feeling of being not myself. Probably it was like I was fun, I was outgoing, I was the party, like basically always willing to have a good time. And I always told myself, I'm like, I'm young, and time passed me by and it was like, I'm not young anymore, and I wasn't happy with where I was, and I was looking at life and I was like, what is going on? But I continued to do it because I didn't know anything else. So the drinking led me into cocaine. I started using cocaine at 18 years old. It wasn't even with peers. It was with younger people, and that's what made me feel comfortable. Like, wow, I'm going to start doing this drug with people that are younger than me. It can't be that bad. So I started using, and eventually I fell into opiates. I was bartending, working three jobs, and I was always out partying 3 to 4 days a week, and I needed something to keep me going. So I started using opiates. That took a little toll on me. So I was like, well, I don't want to drink anymore. I'll just do opiates. So I was able to kind of fool everybody at this 25-year-old mark. No, it wasn't 25. It was 21. So I was like, hey, I'm not young anymore, I'm older, but I'm not drinking. So I promoted, like, I'm not drinking, and little did anyone really know, I was a full-blown opiate addict. I didn't even know myself, I wasn't aware. So I came in to check once I found out I was pregnant. I was 3 weeks pregnant. I was early in my pregnancy, and I had to make a decision. And the decision was, this child deserved a life that wasn't the life that I was given. Not to say that my life was bad, it's just that my parents only knew what they were taught. So I wanted to change that. I wanted to break the cycle with her. So I made a decision, and that decision changed my life for the rest of my life.
So can you share with us what that decision was?
It was to have my daughter and to become sober. So I became sober.
So what are the steps that you took to become sober?
I actually did the opiate recovery cold turkey. I just quit and I made a decision that day. It wasn't difficult for me, thank God, because come to find out, like, opiate addiction is the hardest to come off. So it was like, it was so easy for me. It was a breeze, and I'm thankful for that now, knowing what I know now of how bad it is, the opiate addiction.
So really the turning point for you was becoming pregnant. Yeah. And you wanted a change of life.
Yes, I wanted to give my daughter something else. I wanted her to be the change in this world, in a sense, you know, have this direction that I didn't have.
Okay, so on that journey, what were some of the things, are there other things that you did to help you in terms of sobriety? And
I started working with KSCS when I was pretending to be sober, and it didn't work because I wasn't really dealing with anything. I was just pretending. So I start following back up with them. I said, look, like, I'm really changing. I'm really getting this together. Can yous really help me direct me? And they said, of course we can. So I start working with them, and anything my addictions worker ever threw at me, I was more than willing to take on. So we started with the codependency. I went to a codependency program, and it required me to be sober. And I was already a month sober, so I was like, you know what, I could do this, and I can make this work. So I decided to go to a codependency program, and that actually was one of the biggest lifesavers, too.
So I guess share a little bit about codependency. What does that mean?
It comes down to sort of how you see yourself in a lot of ways, right? So it would be the individual's self-esteem and how they use a relationship with somebody else to either make them feel better about themselves or to make decisions or to really help guide them rather than being able to rely on themselves in some ways. But it when we talk about codependency, it's kind of like a two-way street, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not just about that one individual. Yeah. It's, you know, the person they're relying on is also relying on them, and
caretaker responsibility and a martyr role.
Mm-hmm. So it can be, and it, you know, it's different for everybody. So, but it's an important aspect of, you know, when you're looking at why did I develop an addiction? Why do these substances make me feel good? Why do I like this feeling so much? Why is it so important to me? So, you know, when we talk about a relationship with substances, we have to look at our relationships with relationships. You know, and it's not to say that anybody would point the finger at someone else for saying, you know, you're the reason I have an addiction. That's not it. It's just when we talk about addictions, we're talking about health. When we talk about health, it's not just your physical health, it's your mental health, your emotional health, your spiritual health, and you have to get down to all of that stuff because it's not the substance, it's something at the root of you.
Yeah.
Right.
And is that explained for you?
Yeah, it was the martyr role. I kind of grew up in a codependent environment, and it's generational, so it's learned behavior. You are as good as what you know, so I kind of...
No, it's true.
Yeah, no, so it's I grew true. Up in the environment of the martyr role, so caretake and be responsible for the person using and cleaning up everything and making sure everything looked fine. So, you know, that wears on you after a while. You have to come to a decision because you're not taking care of yourself anymore. You're so concerned with the other person that it's physically making you ill, and you have to step away and look and be like, what is important here? You know, like, it would be great for my daughter to have her family, but at the end of the day, she needed one strong individual, and it had to be me, so I made that decision.
And how long have you been sober?
It was 6 years for the opiates, and I started drinking again after my daughter, and that's when we had, like, a big fight, my daughter's father and myself, and it was just the last straw. It was like, what are we doing? Like, what is she going to be witnessing? And it was everything that I didn't want her to see, and I stopped it, and the codependency program. So it's going to be 4 years in September that I'm not drinking. Yes.
So I guess now as an adult, looking back, was it the right decision for you? Do you feel stronger? Do you feel empowered?
Oh my God, yes. I can't even imagine. Like, I look at my daughter and I'm like, you don't even know how lucky you are, but she's going to find out. Like, she's a gift in herself, and then she's going to have this gift. She's going to be able to share with people because I want her involved in everything I do. I want her to see, you know, and help people. And that's what I want to do with this sobriety. It's like, I want people to understand you're not alone, and we could all come together and help each other instead of pretending like I didn't have an addiction problem, or, you know, raise your head and act like you never were anything. Like, I know where I came from. I'll never forget that, and I'll sit at a table and talk with anyone about it.
And I think you're raising an excellent point, and one thing I had wanted to talk a little bit about was the facade life that people who are addicted or prior to becoming sober live. Most people would look at you and say there's nothing wrong with her or yourself, Dan. You know?
Absolutely.
So my question is how do you maintain that? You know, how do you maintain one visible life, but behind, you know, live a different life? You know, when you look back.
I actively talk about my sobriety because it took a while to get to this point. Before it was like, I didn't do any of that. Like, what are you talking about? And then I went away to a codependency program and I had to sit in a room. And it was actually an awesome dynamic. It was a rehab center and the codependency. So the codependents learned off the rehab people and the rehab people learned from the codependents, which was the best. Like, it was crazy. So I had to sit there and be like, hi, I'm Leora, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, and I'm a codependent. And when I had to say that, it was like a big realization, and it lifted off my shoulders. I was like, okay, I'm proud of this now. I could take pride in who I am and not have this follow me as the worst things I've ever done.
Yeah, before I got sober, very few people would witness the internal turmoil I was in. I had the opportunity to work with a girl's son that I went to high school with, and I told her what I was going through in the inside, and she couldn't imagine, because on the outside I was good in sports, I was popular, I always had girlfriends and I had a lot of friends, but nobody knew the internal. It was always bury it down and put on the brave face and smile. But when I was alone, it was a different story. And until I got well, until this past, and the process is continuing. I can see the different stages of my wellness in the past 6.5 years. And in the right now, I'm probably better than I've ever been. The fear, the dishonesty and selfishness is pretty much gone. You know, I live free today. And this is exactly why I'm here today, because I know the suffering of active addiction, and I know the pain and the loneliness of it. But whenever I get a chance to speak of sobriety and the benefits of it, and that it is possible, I'll do it.
Yeah. So I guess leading me to the question, how do you maintain your sobriety now? And what are some of the things that you've used or techniques or programs to help you stay sober? Because I know it's not always easy.
No, definitely. I'm never going to be free of this. I call myself a recovered alcoholic, meaning that the obsession has been lifted from me. I'm not cured of it. I cannot safely ingest alcohol in any fashion and be okay. The way I do this is the process that I was shown is a 12 steps in a 12 step fellowship where you make three decisions that you're powerless, and then you do an inventory of your grosser handicaps, meaning who you're resentful at, what are you afraid of, and who have you harmed. You identify those character defects, and you ask your creator to alleviate those from you, and then you go about about the next stage of rectifying your past, cleaning up the harms you've done. And then today, the way I live is through that same process of there's a morning meditation where I'll start my day in a quiet time, and throughout the day, if I do harm somebody, if I am selfish or dishonest, I'll try to rectify that as fast as I can. And the most important thing that enables me to stay sober today is to carry this message to other people who are still suffering. I judge my sobriety by three things: am I free, useful, and happy? And yes, most of the time I am.
That's awesome. Leora?
Oh, what's the question?
The question was, is like, in terms of your sobriety, what do you use to maintain? Because I was saying it's not always easy, you know? And both of you have had several attempts at doing it. So, you know, what are the things that you use or programs that keep you going?
I work with KSES up to this day. I have an addictions worker. And whatever the addictions worker ever presented with me, I was willing to do. I was like, yes, let's do it. So I did a lot of spiritual healing. I did a lot of our own medicines. I start working with that. And it just it kept leading me somewhere. And it never stopped. Exactly what he said. Like, you never stop growing. So, like, once one door opens, I was willing to open the next one quicker and quicker, and it just, anything that could help me, I'm willing to take on.
And I'm glad you mentioned that about the culture and cultural aspects. Sure. Dan mentioned the same thing, and I can't help but that being a very cornerstone of who we are,
yep.
The essence, you know, and finding that out. And when we're younger, we have no connection to it, not the way we could have, you know, given all the things we've gone through in our lives. But as we get older, that connectedness is empowering.
Absolutely.
You know?
I was we were raised in the church when I was growing up. My mother, I asked her, because my great-grandma spoke only our language, and then my grandmother spoke both languages, Ojibwe and English. And my mother's generation, all her siblings, most of them only spoke English. So one day I asked her what had happened, and she said that that's the residential system came in and pretty much put an end to that. So on my reserve, the culture is it's starting to grow back, but it's very important, I believe, to continue these things. Because when I went back, I sat down with my buddy Keith. He runs a sweat lodge back home, and there was a contentment there. We were in the bush on the outside of the sweat lodge. We just talked, and he was a great help to me, benefit to me in early recovery. He brought me in. We the first time I was in the sweat lodge, I thought I was all, like, I was sober at the time, and I thought I was all spiritually well. And I got in there and I cried harder than I've ever cried in my life. And we burned the towel afterwards that I was crying into, and the freedom that I garnered from those experiences were enormous.
Do you have anything on, you know, the cultural aspect of it? And
oh, for sure. We're so disconnected, and once you connect yourself, it's just the most amazing feeling. Like, that was, and it still plays an active role, because I never understood the spirituality concept. It's like you could be traditional, you can go to a longhouse, but you're still not connected to something, a greater good, you know. And being in AA, like you said, it's very godly, and you're sitting there and you're like, wait, why are they talking about God? But it's so easy to transition it to something that you can connect to, and it could always be anything.
So, you know, as we're listening, you know, you hear in each of our guests' stories, you know, these different elements, and I just, you know, we have to talk about addictions in a way that we understand that it's many layers of what's going on with people, and how, you know, our intergenerational trauma plays into that. So a lot of times when somebody's living with addiction, there seems to be a big blame factor, that person doesn't have willpower, that's a weak person. But we have to look at the bigger context of what happened before them.
Exactly.
What came before that person. And, you know, we're born as, you know, just these, you know, free little human beings, but the generations before us are carrying so much pain that whether they intend to or not, it's passed on to us. So, you know, and when we don't have those spiritual tools with how to cope with the pain, how to cope with the anxiety, how to cope with the doubt, it becomes very easy to turn to substances that just erase all of those concerns from your mind, rather than actually, you know, dealing with your emotions and what you're going through. You know, so, you know, blaming somebody for being an addict, it doesn't help them.
No.
Right? And it just adds another layer of pain and trauma onto that person.
And I think I just want to point out, as Dan was talking about his community, it sounded like he was just right here from Gunawage, you know? No different than our community, you know? And interesting thing. So while we're at this juncture, we'll take a little break and we'll be right back.